Hello and welcome to the Lakeshore Records podcast on Cue. I'm your host, DeLon Leviton, and I had the great pleasure of speaking with composer Trevor Gorecki about his killer scores for Dead Space, Servant, and more. In our wide-ranging conversation, we discussed the visceral sound of Dead Space as an intimate journey through hell, Trevor's outside-the-box collaboration with M. Night Shyamalan, and how the master of thrillers keeps him on his toes, Philip Glass's minimalism versus a more dense maximalist approach to composition, the influence of Aphex Twin and Stanley Kubrick, pushing the boundaries of organic instruments, archetypal dread and Dante's Inferno, and so much more. Trevor's scores for Dead Space and Servant are out now worldwide via Lakeshore Records.
Welcome, Trevor. Congratulations on the incredible, overwhelmingly positive reception of the game.
Thank you.
And your score is phenomenal. I love how there's a level of chaos and cacophony, and a mixture of really cool, what you might call traditional orchestral soundscapes and synth beds, which we'll get into. But first off, how are you?
I'm good. Good. Been busy, but also super excited about today, about the release day. I think I started Dead Space back in like the summer of 2021 or something. It was a really long process to put it all together. And it's just great to like get here. And then also that it's been so well received already. So, yeah.
Was it just that you have Servant, you've got a lot of things that you've been working on. Is that part of the time that it took?
I think they wanted to start the EAA Motive team, they wanted to start, you know, they wanted to give themselves a lot of time to think about how music was going to function. I mean, they were going to keep some of the original score for sure. But then it was like, so what are we going to do with some of the new musical ideas? And what narrative opportunities could we have now that we're taking another look at this? And that was really, could only do it with sort of experimentation, exploring the idea, the basic lore of the game, kind of stepping back and saying like, all right, the Unitology religion, cult, like what is that sound? What is Nicole's relationship with Isaac, his girlfriend that he's going to see? What if we, explored that more and had music play a bigger role in that, as an example.
So what did you find were your, initial challenges getting into this? I mean, because you are, as you touched upon, you are coming into a situation where there is a pre-existing reference.
Yeah. I mean, I wanted to definitely find a sweet spot where the score was, that I was making was jiving with the original score. So that we, as a gamer myself, I wouldn't feel like there was a sudden bump where we were like, oh, whoa, this is like a different thing, And everyone's on the same page. We were all like, we want to hit some new narrative concepts. We want to hit some, teleological things that like occur like across the entire game. And then maybe like even hit some like major set pieces, like the big boss battles and redo them. But in doing so, that would be like, taking some of the old score or the original score and then having it kind of run up to what I have. And they kind of have to like, jive and like be able to like coexist in the same universe. So I was, familiar with the game. I played it myself back in 2008. And was really familiar with the score as well, because I thought it's a great score. Jason Graves did a phenomenal job at creating this like universe of Dead Space over three games. And so I was sort of taking some of the sounds that he had, which were kind of like inspired, I think, and he's talked about this too, by like classical composers like Penderecki and Ligeti, and you know, who were used in like Stanley Kubrick's you know, The Shining or 2001 or that kind of thing. Or you know, even like Jerry Goldsmith. I don't know if he said this, but you know, I think Jerry Goldsmith scored it to Alien, or James Horner Aliens is a good example of kind of the world of which Dead Space One kind of exists. And so I kind of employ some of the performance techniques in my score as well, like brass doing the same kind of like stinger hits, and strings doing like shrieks and that kind of stuff. But that's kind of like playing on the same ball, you know, on the same field to begin with. And then I started to explore, well, what was my kind of role in this? And that was, at first it was again to see what the narrative opportunities were, and then it was to get a little bit more involved and expand some new terrain into boss battles and cutscenes and all this kind of stuff. So kind of expanded over time, but yeah.
And you know, to my ear, a lot of what's really interesting is it sort of sounds like you're playing on the fringes or the outer limits of what you can do with instruments.
Yeah.
Where it's almost like exploring the space between what one might call music and sound. Well, like what is music, right? What is sonorous versus what is something that creates this, I recently learned this word, anxiogenic sort of feeling, where it's like, yeah, something that induces anxiety.
Yeah, right? Okay, right.
I think that's what it means.
Yeah.
And to me, that's a really interesting sort of space to be in. And I'm curious how conscious you are of it sounding quote unquote musical.
Yeah. Right. So there's definitely an element of like exploring the sound of the ship, which has its mechanical and I mean the ship at the, you know, to some degree is alive, so it has also like a living element to it. And then I like to use organic instruments, meaning like, you know, violin and cello and even piano and things in non-traditional ways, not only because that's kind of some of the reference material in terms of like Penderecki and Ligeti and Jason Graves' original score, but I think that stuff is great for like, I mean, it is sort of the dialect or the language of horror music. Often there's a play extended techniques and play things in a very wrong but different way, you know. So you know, you play like with a violin, you play like on the other side of the bridge, you get all these kind of whistle tones and harmonics, and then if you're on the cello, I would do things like pitch it down an octave or add an extra octave with the distortion pedal kind of thing, and then kind of make it sound like a screaming animal, you know. I just try to like come up with you know, almost analogs to what's happening in the game, or you know, as well, but also create interesting textures. There's lots of percussion sounds that I have with not only samples, but like metallic percussion instruments that I have in my studio, like this Marvin instrument that's like a metal welded instrument. And so I use that those kind of things to bring some tactile qualities in the midst of a full orchestra, because we did three big orchestra sessions with choir, you know, like a 80 piece orchestra or something. But then also I was recording all this like close mic stuff of me playing violin and cello and all this other stuff. So it was like kind of a duality between like the very big expansive hits and massive, you know, scares, but then that intimate creepiness.
Yeah, I think that, you know, it's Dead Space. The title also signals a lot, right? Just having dead space. And there's the dread of the unknown out in this, you know, massive landscape that's unimaginable. And the whole survival aspect of it is really interesting. And I wanted to ask you a really dumb question that I will apologize for. How do you find the balance, or do you even think in these terms when you're, if you're scoring a video game that's literally survival horror?
Yeah.
How do you find a balance where, like, if everything that you're doing is incredibly tense and everything that you're seeing is incredibly tense, is there a too far? Like, is there, can you always go to 11?
Yeah. I mean, I think the score, like, in has its moments of reflection.
Absolutely.
Which I really wanted to capture because it is an intimate story, as weird as that to imagine. But, you know, Isaac is going in this journey into hell, essentially, and searching for his girlfriend. And, you know, in doing so, he, there's really melodic stuff, and there's very like straight piano things, but then it, and it definitely does devolve into textures of just like total chaos and everything. So it's like kind of plays between those two things. And then there's you know, like the more finale kind of things, like the hive mind track, which is like the most like chaotic and bombastic thing ever. And that stuff is like you know, pushing it as far as it can go each time. Just keep going higher and higher and raising it and one step, like maybe one baby step back and then jumping up and then keep going. It's like one big 8 minute like run to the exit kind of thing. So.
Yeah, to echo what you said, a couple of things you said, for me, to my ear, what I really loved about it was the range. And for me, what kind of encapsulates the range, to my ear, was sort of the space between a track like The Hive Mind and it was Nicole's Theme, I think it's called.
Yeah.
And then somewhere in between, what I really loved for me was Make Us Whole.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that one I actually found to be one of the most, sort of, I don't know if insipid is the right word, but, it was a really intriguing track for me because there's almost this Gregorian chant element to it. And you have these human voices and it's very relatable and accessible in a certain way and traditional in a certain way,
right?
But completely not. And so you have this great marriage.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And I think that's like, you know, part of what makes some of the stuff that we were trying to explore interesting, because we wanted to see like what's, you know, that duality of normal and not normal, or like are placing those things together often. That piece, the choir, there is a choir that's singing like straight actual pitches, don't, you know, please sing a tune kind of stuff. But right behind that is like a friend of mine singing like all these like throat tones just kind of floating around in the stereo image. So it's like, you know, like, right, you know, you where you think it's there's always like a little bit of a surprise sometimes, you know.
You also touched upon something I was going to ask you about. I was curious if you have any sort of, I know that you have a classical background.
Yeah.
But I was curious if you actually have any sort of religious background.
Not really. I mean, I was raised Catholic, and parents were dad was a dentist in the military. So we, I guess the Catholic Church was like, you know, in the whatever, wherever we were stationed, just so many different places, but that was always around. But I think we kind of moved past it at a certain point.
The only reason I asked was because you used the word hell, and that is exactly what I thought. I thought Trevor needs to score like actual hell.
Yeah, yeah,
It was, for me personally, I was, what you literally said, exactly what I thought. It's a person going to save their girlfriend from hell, basically.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, well, I mean, I got that whole concept. It was not an original one. It's a concept of it, the journey to hell, because it was the one of the writers of the game gave me a presentation. Her name is Jo Barry, about it, and it's Dante's Inferno, right, where he goes to the, like, in a journey, he goes to hell and comes back, or I don't know the soul, I don't remember the whole story, but when she was explaining the concept of it, then I was like, whoa, Dead Space is kind of like that. Like, it just blew my mind, like the idea that maybe this is very, it could have been, I mean, I was a gamer, I played it, I didn't know that possibly that was one of the inspirations for the story, or what, kind of, like, you know,
fascinating,
maybe like a something, but maybe she used it as a story device to help her guide. But it totally makes sense, especially since people get continually more lost as they go, and further they go, and closer to the marker. And that's the idea. I mean, which is one of the things that we wanted to explore, was the idea of the corruption that gets closer and closer to the marker. Everyone starts having visions of, you know, other characters in the game, including Isaac. And, you know, things just sort of fall off and get stranger and stranger. And I was writing music to be used, like, progressively, more as it goes. So, like, the tram sequence, like the tram system, which is the way that you kind of get around the ship. The further you get in the game, the more, like, the corrupted elements that I wrote. I wrote like a corrupted version of the tram music, gets implemented into the game as you get further along, to kind of heighten the sense of, like, that, you know, you're losing your mind.
That is so interesting on so many levels. I have to say, a little bit of a tangent here, but I literally was envisioning, there's a Dante's Inferno. I was in, you know, the different layers.
Yeah, right, totally.
And there's actually an artist, Gustave Doré, who has some really amazing illustrations of it that,
right,
I have to send to you, because that's what I was envisioning. And I found that to be a really intriguing experience, because we're talking about space, and, you know, this is illustrations from like the 1800s, basically.
Yeah, right.
You know, based on previous a book from, you know, far earlier. So it's really, really fascinating. I feel like you touched upon some sort of archetypal dread.
Yeah, it is. It is like yeah, the idea of that, of traveling there and getting there, and that journey. And I'm, you know, I excuse me. One second. During the process, I never get to play it, because I working more with just like video assets or just sort of ideas, and we talk about things in the abstract. So I finally have a copy of it. And I get to play tonight, so I get to, like, I'm not finish it in a night, but still, I'm gonna, like, start and you know, go on that journey and see what it feels like to actually with all my music, which should be fun.
Yeah, that'll be really fun. I mean, it's also like there's something meta to it, right? Because you get to control how much of what music you hear and when, right? As you play.
Yeah. Right.
I'd be curious to see your choices. I'm curious, generally speaking, what is your relationship to horror? Like growing up, or what were your horror influences? Were you into horror?
Not necessarily. I was always into contemporary music. So does that mean I was into horror music? I don't know. But I was classically trained, like classical composition trained. So I went to Yale for composition, and you know, it's funny that music and the performance techniques and the styles of writing, again, it's like you can take that stuff and you put it against picture, and just like what's that Greek director, Largos, like his name,
Lanthimos, something like that.
Largos, yeah. Lanthimos. Yeah, he uses like Alfred Schnittke, a great composer. From where is he from? I think he might be Austrian or something, but I knew his music, like his piano concertos and stuff, and they sounded like great, like contemporary piano concertos. But then you see them in his films, and it's like it's horror music, because it's like dissonant sounding, you know, dissonant chords, and like, you know, really intense stuff. So I like that. I mean, I liked that stuff. I liked the like musically intense, like classical music, I guess, you know. And that's what I was writing and kind of had my eye on. I got into like the kind of more horror genre when I was working with M. Night Shyamalan for all these years. But that's, you know, when I started Servant, I was mostly listening to like Anton Webern, who's like, you know, from like the 20s or something, a German composer, who was not thinking like he was writing music for horror stuff at all. But again, it's like the sound and the delicacy and the emptiness of it for season one, that was much more of an empty score, made that kind of vibe, you know.
I love that there's, in Servant in particular, there's this sort of, I'm not sure sweet is the right word. It's a little bit of a lullaby energy at some points.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And, like main theme.
Yeah.
Leanne's theme kind of.
And then it's sort of like what we were touching upon earlier, that it's the spectrum, right? There's this, and mm-hmm. that's part of what I really enjoy about horror, is that it tends to cover the gamut of emotion and sound.
Yeah. And you know, and speaking of that, I think that a lot of horror scoring composers, you know, from what I've seen, you know, and seeing movies or whatever, I do think it's like a really great atmosphere, a great place for composers to experiment and write really fantastic music. Is in the kind of, it's almost like it's an extension of the classical universe or something. I don't know. It kind of like, because it was, some of that music was taken and put to picture, and it kind of, some of that of that dialect, you know, those techniques and concepts, if you're writing in horror scores now, like you're kind of that lineage in a way.
You touched upon M. Night, you know, one of the greats of our time, and clearly a, you know, cinematic horror thriller tension master.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if you could maybe give us a little tidbit of what that relationship is like, or what it's like to learn from him, if there's work with him, learn from him, collaborate with him, if there's anything that is salient that comes to mind in that collaboration?
Yeah, I mean, I worked with him since like 2019, I guess. So it's what does that make, like 4 years? Across, you know, four seasons of 40 episodes of a TV show and a movie as well. And it's been amazing. Like, he's incredibly an intuitive director who understands music really well, understands scoring and spotting the function of music. I learned about what scoring is really from working with him, I feel, because he, you know, he has a very like clear sense about how score can work and like how it can play to subtext and what's happening on off screen and all these kind of really powerful ways. You know, he can really, and he's also really like challenging in terms of bringing out like some of the best work that I've done, because he, you know, he's always pushing for like, you know, like nothing is like recycled and nothing is new, you know, everything is like really pushed to the limit, you know.
Does working on a on something with M. Night, does it carry with it any different sort of approach or experience than maybe the other projects, in that specifically the audience has a certain level of expectation? Just if his name is attached,
yeah,
right, then we know we're in for something. And so I wonder, right, do you find yourselves having to play with those expectations?
I think like maybe a little bit, you know, but he really does keep to what the project is he's working on, an episode or the movie he is at the time. And I guess if you mean like the if there's going to be a twist at the end or something.
Yeah,
or
something to that degree, like, yeah.
Yeah, you know, it was, I think he uses that maybe as like I think he's talked about it being sort of like often a helpful writing device for himself. But like the, you know, in terms of the music though, he likes, you know, original ideas that just don't sound familiar. You know, I think a lot of the times that he would ask me to do revisions or rewrites, it could sometimes go back to like, it sounds too normal, you know, like just, you know, like the, if I played a clarinet part or something and it wasn't like a little bit messed with or something. So I learned a lot about texturing and creating veiling stuff and that kind of, because I think that he wanted to always be like, no, but not really no, kind of, I guess. Mm-hmm. Like musically, you know.
And zooming out a little bit, how do you characterize your, I don't know, your gig? Like what is it that you, what is your job? What is it that you are here to do?
I'm here to keep writing music whenever people are curious about asking to do it. Like I kind of follow the path that comes up in front of me. Like I started that company the composer Jay Wadley at Found Objects, like I don't know how many years ago now, 12, 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. I still have that, and we're, you know, it's main focus is original music and sound for advertising. I don't really do much of that work for that anymore, but I'm still like, you know, part owner. And so I'm definitely involved in the business of it, but say for him. And so like we both kind of like created that, and it's become like a foundation that's allowed us to kind of step back and do more film and TV stuff. And now that I, you know, did my first big video game, I'm hoping to do more video games because that seemed cool. But like I had done like, you know, like worked with like, you know, Kanye West when he was like normal back in 2015. And that was like a fun like side thing. And I was like interested in doing like production stuff for a while. And that didn't really go that too far. So then I just kind of went to the next thing, you know, I just kind of go where things kind of go, you know. And and that's kind of how I take it. It's sort of like if there's something that comes up that sounds like a cool project, or you know, I mean, I would love to work on something that's like my own thing one day, because I very often, you know, composers get caught up like providing, you know, like become basically like the media composer, right? Where you're just writing music for other people's work constantly. I do like having deadlines and having picture and things to work against, because my wife, like her name is Sugar Mandil, and she's like a really talented composer, but she doesn't do this kind of stuff. She does like more experimental concert music and mostly disciplinary art, that's terrifying. She has to like come up with everything. Like she has to come up with a whole like concept and the media and the whole thing. And I'm more fulfilling tasks for other people, which at least gives me some like guidance. But yeah.
Do you have a sense of what, when you say making something that is your own, is there, you know, you've got multiple talent sets, let's say, right? Yeah. In different spheres. Like I get it, it's all music, but music production is completely different.
Totally. So yeah, I mean, I've always wanted to like get back into doing more like electronic music. I've been doing like so much orchestral and chamber like orchestral and bigger and bigger and bigger. And that stuff's like super awesome. But I really loved doing like, you know, some of the pop stuff I've done in the past. So maybe it would be something more along the lines of that, I guess. But I don't know. I mean, but you know, I also have a 2 year that we've talked about, but I also have a 2 year old, and so that's like a whole project itself.
Yeah. I'm curious, does your 2 year old react to your music in any particular way?
I mean, actually, I tend not to like play my music at home for him or anything. I just feel like it's just bringing work home or something. But I know that he has like really strong taste in music. Like if I play something that he doesn't like, he'll just be like, no, he'll try to turn it off. So I should do a test and I'll find like the most tame track and just see if he has any reaction. I'm pretty sure he'll probably want to turn it off pretty quickly.
Correct me if I'm wrong. I think I've read, or maybe when we spoke previously, that you referred to some of your music as having a maximalist approach. Is that right?
Yeah.
Can you expand on that?
I think that's sort of a product of development and texture, and my process of writing is very like fairly quick, but also lots of layers. So I might take a simple patch, make small adjustments to it. But it's really about that patch plus like four other different things that come together to make that sound that occurs, you know? So in a way it's like, it's orchestration, like even within the electronics that are happening on. So it's like, you know, like to create like a moment, one moment is hit with like five, six different things that are happening with a brass hit, and then a string thing, and it's so, you know, it's, there's a lot of material happening all the time for like a density. And I don't know if it's like a, it's not a philosophy necessarily, because I certainly like minimal things. My favorite composer is probably, living composer is probably Philip Glass, and I love all of his like early works, which are really even the most minimal of his stuff. But I do tend to write things that kind of get additive in terms of textures and process to kind of create kind of a sound design music hybrid element, you know. In the midst of like that being there, and then there'll be like a pretty normal piano melody, like right in the middle, like played there. So it could be like that piano melody is played, and you have like one bass drone, that could be the piece too. But I tend to kind of have like a lot of stuff going on a lot, which I think to me gives a lot of contour. I guess it's like a more of a like a personal a taste in terms of what I'm writing, and that's how I kind of like get to a final version of something.
It's interesting also in that it can provide a signature, right? It's like more opportunity to put your own stamp on something, right? Mm-hmm. There's like multiple dimensions, and mm-hmm. it's nice. One thing that I appreciate about your music when it is maximalist, I mean, I appreciate the minimalist stuff too. I love your piano melodies, honestly, is that it's sort of like this pushing of the boundaries. I feel like you're constantly pushing a boundary. And, you know, it's interesting to think hypothetically, if you might've added a couple more layers, it might've been too much. And so you put my ear right where it should be on the edge.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely play with audibility and like readability in terms of like where my ear is being tracked in a cue or something on a track, right? So it's like, even though there's a lot of sounds going on, but I could still track like maybe like the or woodwind lines are leading my ear right now. Even there's all sorts of crap going on, like it's just everywhere, but it's sort of like I'm really being tracked this way, and then like, all right, now the brass is leaving my ear, and then this is leaving my ear. You know, I'm sort of like, I'm still able to kind of follow a through line of like a cognitive, like a concept, you know?
I love that. I love the way you articulated that too, because that has been one of my, in writing music, I've had that be an Achilles heel, where I have definitely fallen into, well, this is interesting, and this is interesting. And right. Sort of lose the plot.
Yeah. No, it's like, and then if you're working on a movie or a show or something, you also have like people and talking sure. and stuff. It's like, you're trying to like navigate between all these things, but, and that's like a interesting experience how to like learn how to do it. And like, you know, fail all the time. It's so hard. It's definitely like, I definitely want there to be a cognitive ability or a level of like cognition involved where you can like understand what's happening. And it's not just total, even if I say it's like total mayhem, it's not like so total that you just sound like nothing. It just sounds like absolutely.
Yeah, it's listenable mayhem.
Listenable, right. You can understand like the next thing happened. Oh, and then something else happened. And then something else happened, you know.
Yeah.
You could like mark it kind of like, oh, this is something changed, instead of just like a whole orchestra playing just like random, you know.
Some rapid fire questions before we wrap up. If top three heroes or artistic influences that just come to mind right now?
Philip Glass, which I always I have huge respect for. Top three. I'm terrible at rapid quit. St. Stanley Kubrick, my favorite movie is 2001. So I kind of like live in that movie. But also, I've been really like, I'm not an avid reader, but I've been going through a lot of like series by like movies and stuff of Isaac Antonov's stuff.
Cool. Nice. What about in the pop world? You mentioned you have a background there. I'm curious, like, who influences that come to mind?
Aphex Twin probably is like one of the earliest. Let's see.
I would be really curious to hear you navigate in that space.
Yeah, I mean, I used to have a band that was like all, and I did all the electronics and did production. I didn't sing, but I did the
production
part. And they were called My Great Ghost. It's not music up, but
check it out.
Yeah.
What do you have any sort of dream project or collaboration?
Dream project collaboration. I mean, I really enjoyed working on Dead Space, and I would love to get more into that world for sure. Like, my favorite game is Mass Effect. I've played that like so many times. So Mass Effect 1-3, and then Andromeda and all that. So I mean, I'm sure they're coming up with a new one of these days.
It's just a thought experiment. We talked a lot about hell, so we can, for the thought experiment, talk about heaven. You die, you get in front of God or whomever in heaven, and they're like, you know, it's your moment to be judged, and they're like, can you play us a song? What do you do?
Play us a song. Well, to be judge on my work, on my kid. That's where you really get judged, right? Like, raise this kid. I've got to think about that. I mean, I think that I really do kind of live in the moment. So maybe I'm thinking like what I have, like out now, I guess. So that's kind of maybe that's kind of lame, but I mean, I really did like the score I wrote for The Goldfinch back in 2019.
Yeah, nice.
I know that movie was not that great or whatever, but there's the final track of that piece. It's called, what's it called? Beautiful Things.
Cool. Nice little,
that's a nice heaven piece. Nice. I'm playing piano and everything, so.
Yeah. You're in. You're fast. Enter. Last question. Practical advice you might have for upcoming musicians, artists, composers.
Yeah, I mean, I think I generally have the point of view that that things kind of I mean, there's just so much luck involved with this field, and really you never know where things come from. So when things, and I always reference like a river. I don't know why the river, but it's just sort of like when I started the advertising company about Found Objects, like we were just doing like small, tiny little ads and just doing like whatever side work for whenever they couldn't afford built glass and, you know, that kind of stuff. We were just doing like whatever kind of projects that we could do. And it was just like taking the opportunities that came and anything that came up. And I think that kind of like take it all in attitude can, you know, is a good, like for me at least, was a good, like when I was young. Not, I mean, now it'd be probably problematic to be too much, but you know, it's definitely, you don't like pigeonhole yourself into anything too early. Don't set yourself up for like some expectation about something, because you never know what kind of career you're going to have, honestly. Like if you're going to be working in pop production, or if you're going to be doing orchestration, or, you know, to be working in music, you know, is like a really lucky life. So, like, you know, you kind of just have to see where those opportunities are and go for them. And, you know, one thing could be just like a small little side project that, you know, 5 years later we'll be like, hey, actually, can you score the whole thing now?
Great. Well, thank you so much, Trevor, for your time.
Yeah,
congrats again. Always nice to talk to you.
Yeah, it's great to talk to you.
Yeah, man. Good luck with everything, and we'll be in touch.
Okay. Thank you.